Good evening. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. On the NewsHour tonight, Russia's Vladimir Putin extends his presidency after securing a preordained fifth term.
A look at former President Donald Trump's violent language on the campaign trail.
And why federal housing assistance is shrinking at the same time rental prices and homelessness are at historic highs.
It's essentially a lottery. Those who are very lucky will get assistance. Everyone else gets nothing.
Welcome to the NewsHour. We begin tonight with two major stories, one related to the 2024 presidential election. The other focused on an election held just this past weekend in Russia.
Today in Moscow, President Vladimir Putin declared his intention to advance deeper into Ukraine and issued new threats against the West, one day after he secured his fifth term in office. It was an election with no suspense, the outcome of which was preordained. Here now is Nick Schifrin.
In Moscow tonight, a celebration and coronation. Tens of thousands in Red Square mark the 10th anniversary of Russia's illegal annexation of Crimea and the man who many call a czar. Last night, Vladimir Putin declared victory with supporters, some who weren't alive when he was appointed president in 1999. He will soon surpass Joseph Stalin to become the longest-running Russian leader since Catherine the Great.
People came to create the conditions for internal political consolidation, to move forward for development and the strengthening of their fatherland, Russia.
Putin's nearly 88% of the vote and record 77% turnout made this a Potemkin plebiscite, especially since at least one city offered voters a chance to win expensive Western electronics, and another offered motorcycles and even apartments. And Putin has launched the harshest crackdown on dissent since the Soviet Union. Putin critics say the country has moved from authoritarian to a dictatorship. But some Russian voters, especially those old enough to remember the chaos of the 1990s, say Putin symbolizes a successful effort to make Russia great again.
I am interested in what is being done now, and I would like it to be continued and even improved, because the younger generation must live in peace and harmony.
Putin's critics call that propaganda and voted with gasoline and a match, including one woman who lit her own ballot after writing, "Bring my husband back." Those who believe the ballot was already spoiled, spoiled an entire box. And others wrote in one name, Navalny. Alexei Navalny, the country's leading opposition figure before he died in mysterious circumstances in prison, had called for Russians to protest by all voting at the same time. And they showed up for noon against Putin, as seen on this video posted by Navalny's team, strength through numbers. That included expats in Berlin, where Navalny's widow, Yulia, who'd echoed her husband's protest call, waited for 6 hours to vote. For Putin, Navalny had been he who must not be named until today, when he said he was willing to include Navalny in a prisoner swap.
On one condition only, I said, so he doesn't come back. But things happen. There's nothing you can do about it.
Even before the elections, we knew that the numbers, that there should be more than 80% people vote for him.
Alexandra Prokopenko is with the Carnegie Russia Eurasia Center and was the advisor to the central bank's deputy governor before leaving to protest the Ukraine war. She says Russia's economy is unhealthy, but has avoided failure despite Western sanctions, thanks to Chinese and Indian willingness to buy Russian oil and massive military spending.
Next 12-18 months are decisive for Ukraine from the pure military standpoint. In terms of this time frame, Putin has enough money to finance the war, to continue and maintain lavish payments on population on during this timeline, and probably to keep inflation moderate.
But there is nothing moderate about Putin, who gets another turn to continue the policies that define his Russia, a nation at war with freedom and its citizens. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Former President Donald Trump is under fire again for comments made during a controversial speech at a campaign event for a Republican Ohio Senate candidate. Extremism experts say it's the latest example of Donald Trump using violent rhetoric to appeal to his supporters.
At a campaign rally in Ohio Saturday, a tribute to those charged and convicted of crimes connected to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol.
Please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
And a vow from the former president to release them.
We're going to work with the people to treat those unbelievable patriots.
As his use of the word bloodbath during an extended riff on the auto industry and Chinese automakers sparked fresh controversy and criticism.
We're going to put a 100% tariff on every single car that comes across the line, and you're not going to be able to sell those cars. If I get elected, now if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath for the whole, that's going to be the least of it. It's going to be a bloodbath for the country. That'll be the least of it.
In a social media post today, Mr. Trump said his threat had been taken out of context and turned the defense of his comments into a fundraising appeal. Well, former President Trump also smart, facing criticism wise, for his dehumanizing anti-immigrant rhetoric at that same rally.
If I had prisons that were teeming with MS-13 and all sorts of people that they've got to take care of for the next 50 years, right? Young people, they're in jail for years, if you call them people. I don't know if you call them people. In some cases, they're not people, in my opinion.
And in a Fox News interview Sunday, he doubled down on past comments about migrants that echo dictators.
Why do you use words like vermin and poisoning of the blood? The press, as you know, immediately reacts to that by saying, well, that's the kind of language that Hitler and Mussolini used.
Well, that's what they say. I didn't know that, but that's what they say. Because our country is being poisoned.
Experts who study extremism say the former president's bloodbath remark is part of an escalating campaign of violent rhetoric.
In this case, it may have been a metaphor. It's hard to tell with him. He was using that language in the context of a discussion of the auto industry, but his meaning was ambiguous, given the way he so frequently calls for or endorses violence. I think it's appropriate to be concerned when he invokes it, even in a seemingly metaphorical way.
Dartmouth College political science professor Brendan Nyhan has closely followed Mr. Trump's commentary about immigrants over the last decade. He says Donald Trump's rhetoric should be viewed through an historical lens.
Donald Trump's descriptions of people from other countries and other racial and ethnic groups as subhuman animals is the kind of language we see in countries before they have ethnic violence or even genocide. It's the kind of language we see when authoritarian movements rise to power. He's appealing to the worst aspects of humanity. It's straight out of the textbooks. And we should be very worried with how mundane it now seems.
President Biden's campaign, in a statement responding to Donald Trump's rally remarks, said, quote, he wants another January 6th, but the American people are going to give him another electoral defeat this November because they continue to reject his extremism, his affection for violence, and his thirst for revenge.
In the day's other headlines, former President Trump's lawyers say he cannot post the bond to cover a civil fraud judgment of $454 million in New York. The penalty is for inflating his wealth and his business dealings. Today, his lawyers told an appeal court that, quote, obtaining an appeal bond in the full amount is not possible under the circumstances. Mr. Trump has until March 25th to pay the full judgment or win a delay. Otherwise, the state could start seizing his assets. A Texas law that gives police broad powers to arrest undocumented migrants is going to stay on hold for now. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito extended a temporary pause indefinitely today. That gives more time to resolve the law's final fate. The Biden administration says it usurps federal authority. Texas officials say the border crisis affects Texans more than anyone else. President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke by phone today amid a growing rift over Israel's handling of the war in Gaza. White House officials say the prime minister agreed to send a delegation to Washington to discuss a planned assault on Rafah in southern Gaza, something the president opposes.
This is not a question of defeating Hamas. And any time I hear an argument that says, if you don't smash into Rafah, you can't defeat Hamas, I say that is a straw man. Our view is that there are ways for Israel to prevail in this conflict, to secure its long-term future, to end the terror threat from Gaza, and not smash into Rafah.
More than 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering in Rafah. So far, though, Netanyahu has insisted the attack must go forward. Inside Gaza, Israeli forces raided the Shifa hospital complex in Gaza City, where some 30,000 Palestinians are sheltering. The Israelis said senior Hamas leaders had regrouped there. They said they killed 20 gunmen, including a Hamas commander. The military released video of the fighting and said troops were instructed on avoiding harm to civilians, but the Gaza Health Ministry reported there were deaths and injuries. A coalition of a dozen governments and UN agencies is warning famine in northern Gaza is imminent. Their report today estimated up to 300,000 people could face starvation by May. But in New York, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the worst is still preventable.
This is an entirely man-made disaster, and the report makes clear that it can be halted. I call on the Israeli authorities to ensure complete and unfettered access for humanitarian goods throughout Gaza, and for the international community to fully support our humanitarian efforts.
In response, Israel's foreign minister accused Hamas of violently interfering with attempts to send aid into Gaza. North Korea fired several short-range ballistic missiles into the sea today. As Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in South Korea, Blinken met with his counterpart in Seoul and joined South Korea's president for a democracy summit. It came days after the South wrapped joint military drills with the U.S. Here at home, the EPA has announced a ban on the last type of asbestos being used in the U.S. It's still employed in making chlorine bleach, car brakes, and some construction materials. Asbestos is known to cause a number of cancers and is linked to more than 40,000 American deaths each year. The National Institutes of Health reports advanced new studies have found no evidence of brain injuries from so-called Havana syndrome. It also offers no explanation for the headaches, balance, and sleeping problems first reported by U.S. Embassy staffers in Cuba back in 2016. A lead researcher says what is clear is that these individuals have real symptoms. They can be quite profound, disabling, and difficult to treat. And on Wall Street, tech stocks led the broader market higher to start the week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 75 points to close at 38,790. The NASDAQ rose 130 points. The S&P 500 added 32. Still to come on the NewsHour, the Supreme Court hears two cases with major implications for free speech. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter break down the latest political headlines. And a teacher's brief but spectacular take on harnessing artificial intelligence in schools.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
We return now to the Russian elections and what Vladimir Putin's continued rule means for Russia, Ukraine, the United States, and the world. Nick Schifrin has more.
Amna, thank you. Joining me now is Fiona Hill. She was the senior director for European and Russian affairs on the National Security Council staff during the Trump administration. She's now a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and the author of Mr. Putin, Operative in the Kremlin. And Yevgenia Karamurza is advocacy director at the Free Russia Foundation, which seeks to promote a free, democratic, and peaceful Russia. Her husband, Russian opposition politician Vladimir Karamurza, is a political prisoner in Russia. Thanks very much to both of you. Welcome back to the NewsHour. Yevgenia Karamurza, let me start with you. What's your assessment of how the election went, as well as the calls for protest, the noon against Putin that we saw people in some parts of Russia, but also across the world?
Well, first of all, thank you for the invitation. And as to the election, so-called election, I don't think that this process that took part in Russia over 3 days can be called an election, because it has nothing to do with a democratic process that is called election in any normal democratic country. This was Vladimir Putin reappointing himself yet again for the fifth time as the president of the Russian Federation in violation of many international laws and having completely destroyed the Russian constitution through the so-called referendum in 2020, which basically made him into a tsar forever. So this process, I don't believe that it can be considered and accepted as a legitimate process by the international community, and I definitely call on the international community to call Vladimir Putin for who he is. He is a dictator and a usurper, and a criminal, actually, wanted by the ICC, definitely not a legitimate leader of the Russian Federation.
Fiona Hill, was this a reappointment, and is Putin a dictator?
Well, it's definitely a re-anointment because it's not just being a dictator, but as Yevgenia said, he's almost a self-styled czar at this point. And in fact, you know, these are the people that he associates himself with in Russian history. In terms of his legacy now, we're all talking about how he will be been in office longer than Catherine the Great, certainly any of the other previous czars. And if he, in fact, extends his term again beyond this current 6 year, after 2030, after 2036, he'll have been in power longer than Stalin. So I think that those legacies, even those terms, tell you enough.
Yevgeny Karamurza, what's the point then? Why go through this stage-managed process? What does the Kremlin benefit?
Well, to create this image of universal support of the Russian population for Vladimir Putin and his policies, both domestic policies and the aggression against Ukraine. Because a lot, this regime depends a lot on this image, on this very warped image of reality. And this is why the call for the noon against Putin, because this was the only way the Russian population was able to show how many Russians were actually opposing these policies because there are no free and fair elections. We understand that whatever we put on those ballots will be counted differently. And of course, there was no surprise in Vladimir Putin winning, maybe in a little bit in the fact that he gave himself over 87% of the vote, which is, I mean, he could be slightly more modest, but no, he had to go that high. And these results were called unprecedented and record by the Russian authorities. So the only way for Russians to actually show what they think of it was to come at the same time at noon to polling stations and see how many of us they are actually in reality.
Fiona Hill, was noon against Putin successful?
Look, I think it was symbolically very important. We'll have to see how we judge success over time. But the very fact that there was signalling that people were dissatisfied in the only way that they could, given the repressive constraints on them, is very important, because there were certainly hundreds of thousands of people. We saw hundreds of thousands of people turning out for Alexei Navalny's funeral, and not just on the day of the funeral, but on the days afterwards.
And doing so despite knowing full well they could be arrested.
Exactly right, knowing that they could be arrested. And also people that turned out, in fact, to sign the forms for the possibility of an alternative candidate, Boris Nedzhdin, to also run against Putin, who ultimately, of course, was disqualified.
Was not allowed, right.
But all of this is very important, because the people who have the courage to do these small acts of defiance are also standing in for, let's just say, all of the other people behind them who just don't have either the wherewithal or are too frightened, in fact, to show their dissatisfaction. So I think we can say from this that it isn't a monolith that Putin is presiding over. And it's 87% of what?
Let's turn to the future. Does Putin use 87%? Does Putin use another election to rule differently, either domestically or internationally? Fiona, I want to start with you.
Well, it's certainly going to give him confidence, and I think we're going to see him use that externally as well. It's the second year anniversary, or just there afterwards, of the full-on invasion of Ukraine. And Ukraine itself was also supposed to have an election coming up. So I would just predict right now that Putin will use the very fact that he's been re-anointed as the Tsar from here to eternity, at least his eternity, perhaps, to make the case that other elections are not being done in the same way, that there's a lack of legitimacy in Ukraine.
But he's long since questioned other elections. He's long since questioned whether there can be any democratic process anywhere. Does he use this election differently, specifically, perhaps in Ukraine or with Joe Biden as president or with the U.S. elections?
Yes, basically to make the point that we all have to deal with him and that we should be considering him and his position and the importance of Russia as an actor when we think about our own policies. So he's definitely going to use this for all he can.
Yevgeny Karamurza, what do you think is the state of Russia's opposition today, and how Putin will or will not treat it differently moving forward?
Well, the reason there is such harsh repression in the country, the reason there these mass arrests, detentions, etc., the reason we have hundreds and hundreds of political prisoners and hundreds of thousands of Russians and being forced out of the country is because this is the alternative. Right. This is the alternative, and Vladimir Putin is doing everything to completely annihilate this alternative so that the world is left to deal with him alone. And this is why I believe it would be so important right now for the international community to do everything to show support and solidarity with those Russians who represent a vision for a different Russia, for Russia, democratic Russia, a normal country, a European country that understands and respects the freedoms and rights of its own citizens and lives in peace with its neighbors. I just understand that for as long as Vladimir Putin remains in the Kremlin, there will be warmongering and there will be repression. And those two things in Russia have always been interconnected. Internal repression always leads to external aggression, and this will go on and on for as long as this regime is allowed to survive.
But Fiona Hill, is Putin isolated internationally? It seems like he has tactical help, certainly on the battlefield, from places like North Korea and Iran. He's getting oil purchases from Iran, and there is a strategic top cover, if you will, from Beijing. How isolated is he or not, and where does he go from here?
Well, that is an issue for us to contend with. And I think it is actually a difficult one. We have to be honest about it. And it's something that we have to keep working on as well. And, you know, I think, you know, part of the problem that we always face, again, is, you know, questions about our own electoral system, which we're right in the middle of right now. Also showing, you know, insufficient, I would say, dedication and resilience when it comes to dealing with foreign policy. And the key for thinking about the answer to this question is how we basically conduct ourselves at this particular point. Now, by we,
so you
I
think
mean
the best
United
thing
States,
that the U.S. could do is actually strengthen itself. You think
that's right, and also strengthen its relationship with its allies and partners. And that's not just with European countries; it's also with countries like Japan, South Korea, Australia, New Zealand. There are a whole host of countries, including countries like India, that have, you know, somewhat ambiguous relationships with Russia that we need to keep reaching out to and trying to kind of push back against the threat that Vladimir Putin poses, not just to domestically in Russia or to Ukraine, but to the larger world system that many other countries have benefited from. So that's a challenge for us, and Putin's thrown that challenge down. I don't think we should give up hope, because I do think that that's signalling from inside of Russia that Yevgenia has talked about shows that, you know, it isn't a monolith inside of Russia, and there are vulnerabilities. And actually, he is quite isolated domestically, right? I don't think he even knows himself, you know, quite how much support he has. But people around him will know how many ballots they're stuffed. They will know how many people they bust out or forced to vote. And eventually, if he shows any kind of weakness internally, you know, there might be another reaction. We've already seen that with Prigozhin and that episode, you know, several months ago. And we've seen it with the outpouring of emotion and support for Alexei Navalny.
And Yevgenia Karamurza, your husband, of course, has long been fighting for some of the changes that Fiona's talking about. He's in prison. How's he doing?
He's doing as well as he can. You know, he still sounds, well, sounds. I haven't talked to him since last summer, but in his letters, he is optimistic, and he sends us words of support. But that's what Russian political prisoners do, amazingly. They are the ones mistreated, they are the ones denied medical care, they are the ones in solitary confinement, and they say about Russia, about the hope for a different Russia, and about that hope living on even after the murder of Alexei Navalny. They say that Vladimir was able to address us during a recent court hearing, and it happened right after Alexei's murder. And he said that, of course, he was absolutely devastated by what had happened, and this was not the first political assassination in Russia's history. But he also said that we cannot give in to despair, because this is exactly what they want us to do, and we need to fight even more. And this is what we owe to our fallen comrades, to continue the fight to make sure that Russia does become what they fought for and died for, a normal European free democratic country. So Vladimir, sitting in this solitary punishment cell in Western Siberia, sends us words of support and encouragement.
Yevgenia Karamurza, Fiona Hill, thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The First Amendment was at the center of two key Supreme Court arguments today. One focused on social media companies' handling of misinformation, while the powerful gun lobby, the National Rifle Association, was at the center of another. Our Supreme Court analyst, Marcia Coyle, joins us now. It's always great to see you.
Good to see you.
So as we said, two big arguments. The first one was about social media companies and whether the Biden administration violated the First Amendment when they flagged COVID misinformation to tech giants like Facebook and X, formerly Twitter. Where were the justices on this case in particular?
Well, the crux of the case, and the second case as well, is really how do you tell when the government has crossed the line between what's permissible persuasion and unconstitutional coercion. In fact, just the Chief Justice framed that as the question, how do we measure this? Significant persuasion enough? What else? In fact, the lawyers for the states that brought this lawsuit said, you don't even need coercion. You just need inducement and encouragement, which Justice Kagan said was, wow, that's so broad, that's so expansive. So they're really trying to find out, you know, where is the line here, and did the Biden administration cross it? And the justices didn't seem entirely sympathetic to the challengers here, the states of Missouri, Louisiana, and five individuals who brought the lawsuit, because they saw a couple problems with the case. First, did these individuals in the states even have the right, the legal right, to sue here? The justices couldn't see a clear line between the claims that the individual said their posts had been taken down because of government action. In fact, Justice Kagan said at one point, there was such a time gap between the communication by the government and what happened to their posts on Facebook. Was it government action or was it the platform's own action? My sense of the argument afterwards was that they're leaning towards, a majority is definitely leaning in favor of the Biden administration here. There was a lot of talk too, Jeff, about, you know, how the government does communicate, how almost every single day you will see a president using the bully pulpit, or you'll see federal officials communicating one thing or another. There's just a lot of back and forth. And Facebook and social media platforms have their own power. They can say no, and they do often, to the government. And also they can turn to officials when they have complaints. So these were all issues that the justices brought up, which lead me to believe that they're leaning towards the Biden administration.
Interesting. We've seen this court take up a number of social media-related cases this term. What does that suggest?
I think it's just the expansion of social media, the amount of information that is going out on these platforms. And it's almost like passage of a big new law. It takes a certain amount of time for issues to percolate from the lower courts up to the Supreme Court. And they're percolating very quickly right now when it comes to social media.
Another First Amendment case that was heard today involved the NRA, and they were actually defended by the ACLU today in a case where the NRA is saying they're being punished for their gun advocacy. Tell us about that.
Right. Their lawsuit was against a New York State regulator of insurance companies and other financial institutions. And they claim that this state regulator had used coercion and threats in order to get certain insurance companies to drop their coverage or their relationship with the NRA. And the NRA has lost a lot of those insurers. And so the court today, you know, also was looking at this coercion or persuasion. But this is an odd case. It's not social media. A lot is going to turn on the communications that the state regulator had with the insurance companies. She claims that she was not coercing them, that one, she was being persuasive and reminding them of the reputational risk they faced of continuing their relationship with the NRA, and also that she was primarily engaged in a law enforcement activity because the NRA was issuing insurance products that were, one, illegal, and the NRA did not have a license. And so she felt that that protected her from any claim of liability. There, too, I think with the court, it's really hard to tell on this one. And I think it's going to come down to how they actually look at, examine closely the sort of guidance letters that the state regulator put out to these financial institutions in order to decide whether it crossed over to impermissible coercion.
Marcia Coyle, our eyes and ears at the U.S. Supreme Court. Thanks as always.
My pleasure, Jeff.
For more on Donald Trump's escalating violent rhetoric, how lawmakers are responding, and the political headlines driving the week, we turn now to our Politics Monday team. That is Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Great to see you both, as always.
Yeah.
So you saw Jeff's report earlier on that violent rhetoric we're hearing from former President Trump. Even after Mr. Trump is confronted about the fact that some of his language echoes the language of Hitler in an interview, he doubles down. This weekend, he said there'd be a bloodbath if he didn't win. Amy, I don't want to ask you about what he said there. I want to ask you about what Republicans have said since then. Senator Bill Cassidy, who has not yet endorsed him, said his comments were on the edge. Speaker Mike Johnson said that Mr. Trump was just referring to the auto industry and that he's 100% correct and Americans agree with him. The decision by fellow Republicans to not unequivocally call out violent rhetoric, what does that say to you?
Though I will point out the one person who did say something, which was Mike Pence, his former vice president, who has announced that he's not endorsing him. Now, when pushed, he's not saying whether he would vote for him or not, but he says he will not endorse him. And he came right out and he said, look, I think the fact that, first of all, you have the president claiming that the January 6th defendants are hostages at a time when we have actual hostages, American hostages in Gaza, is really beyond the pale. And he said, I think that the word he used about, he said, I'll never diminish it, the January 6th, he's saying, that the people moving through the system, they are not hostages, they are defendants. And he said his remarks were unacceptable. Now, that is
what Mike Pence said.
That's what Mike Pence said. If you are on the ballot this year, that is not likely something that you're going to say. Bill Cassidy is not as well, but he also has not endorsed him yet. I think this is the gamble that Trump has been making really since he came down the escalator in 2016, that fundamentally he has a base of voters that are going to stick with him no matter what. There is a bigger coalition of them than anybody appreciates or understands, and that he does not have to worry about alienating everybody else, including people who are in the middle, because his coalition can overtake them. And that is what he's looking at the polls right now, and so are other Republicans that see that the former president's leading the current president right now in polling, and thinking, well, maybe this time there will be enough of those voters. And so we don't want to put our own political opportunities at risk and our own campaigns.
Well, what about those people in the middle? Because the Biden campaign came out very quickly with an edited video featuring those comments, past comments he's made, refusing to defend white supremacists. Are they trying to reach those voters in the middle? Are there persuadables who look at this and say, maybe I won't vote for him now?
The Biden campaign absolutely believes that there are persuadable voters. They look at the voters who voted for Nikki Haley in the Republican primaries, and they say at least some share of those voters could be persuasion targets. There, you know, I was talking with people who were out knocking on doors and campaigning in Waukesha, Wisconsin this weekend. This is a red county, but that has gotten more purple, and they believe that those voters, some of those voters, obviously not all of them, but some of them could be reachable. And it's not just the Trump violent rhetoric that the Biden campaign intends to use. Certainly they are highlighting it and doing everything they can to highlight it. But they really believe that messaging around abortion and reproductive freedom and reproductive rights, that is where some of those same voters would be persuadable. The same people that are turned off by the violent rhetoric or the tiptoe, you know, the footsie with violent rhetoric, are also concerned about abortion rights.
I do want to ask you, Amy, because Mr. Trump was in Ohio at a campaign event for businessman Bernie Moreno, who's one of three Republicans vying for the Senate nomination. This is a state Mr. Trump won by 8 points in 2020. It is winnable by Republicans, but the Democrat incumbent Senator Sherrod Brown remains very popular. How should we look at this, and what can we learn from this about November?
Well, this is one of the handful of states where there actually is a competitive Republican primary. Republicans actually took something from the 22 election to heart, which was they stayed out of these primaries, and the candidates that Trump endorsed ended up winning in almost all of those primaries. Mm-hmm. Those candidates ended up failing in November. And so the approach this year was by the Republican Senate Committee, which is the campaign arm, was to go in and try to clean out these primaries and make an alliance with Donald Trump. Instead of trying to fight him or let him do whatever it is that he was going to do to try to maybe bring him into the tent, say, these are the candidates we think are the strongest, these are the candidates we think you should endorse. Ohio's one of the places where that really didn't work out. And we have another battle between the sort of old pre-Trump party, mm-hmm. which is this candidate that is the closest to the candidate that Trump in terms of the polling. So that wing of the party, endorsed by the former Senator Rob Portman. Mm-hmm. And then you have the candidate that Trump has endorsed, who's also campaigning with people like Carrie Lake mm-hmm. and J.D. Vance, who's the new senator there. So, and the campaign on this side, the Trump-endorsed candidate, is campaigning explicitly on I am the answer as the anti-establishment.
Right.
I will defeat the establishment. So I think that is really much more of the story about whether you're going to see the side that is the more traditional win or the more Trumpified candidate mm-hmm. win, which has really been the story, right, for the last 5 or 6 years in Congress.
Tam, how do you look at this?
In much the same way.
Yeah.
I think we'll definitely be watching to see whether the Trump-endorsed candidate in the Senate race ends up being the one who emerges. Mm-hmm. But in Arizona, for instance, you have Carrie Lake has basically cleared the field. She's someone who failed in her last race, who many establishment Republicans thought was a disaster. She has been a leading election denier and has been out campaigning with Trump. And ultimately, the establishment kind of folded and said, OK, it's Carrie Lake in Arizona. I think Democrats are generally pleased to have that. And I think in Ohio, Democrats want Moreno to be the candidate who the Republicans elevate.
Before I let you go, I need to ask you about other news today, which was a call between President Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, their first call in a month, their first call since Majority Leader Chuck Schumer took to the Senate floor and basically called for regime change in Israel. This has been a private rift that's now out in the open. What does this mean for the White House relationship with Israel right now?
Israel is now going to send a delegation to the U.S. to have high-level meetings about its plan for Rafah. The issue that the White House has is the president has drawn something of a red line, but it's not a really hard and fast one, which maybe means it isn't a red line, about a potential Israeli invasion of Rafah, saying not that Israel can't do it, but that Israel shouldn't do it unless there is a credible plan for getting civilians out of harm's way. And so this meeting is ostensibly about figuring out whether there is a credible plan and having that discussion. But President Biden continues to be in a bind between his progressive left and other voters who do support him, who are more pro-Israel. And, the Biden administration is trying to make this distinction that Benjamin Netanyahu is not Israel, Netanyahu, who is much more closely allied with Republicans. But the politics here are just incredibly challenging for Biden.
Already a busy week. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, always good to see you both. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Unlike other social safety net programs that continue to expand, federal housing assistance has shrunk to its lowest level in nearly 25 years, even as homelessness and rental prices have hit historic highs. Today, only one in four households eligible to receive federal housing assistance actually does. Stephanie Tsai and producer Mike Fritz take a look at why as part of our ongoing series, America's Safety Net.
The rent they're asking, $1,825 a month.
Oh, that's real good. Yeah.
In Mesquite, Texas, a suburb of Dallas, 36-year-old Cassie Lee Williams and her two children need to find a new place to live by the end of the month.
I like the outside.
Like the outside? Mm-hmm.
But first, she and real estate agent LaTanya Donaldson have to find a landlord willing to accept the family's Housing Choice Voucher, also known as Section 8. Housing Choice Vouchers are the federal government's largest form of rental assistance. 2.3 million American households rely on the $30 billion program.
The hardest process is literally the finding process because you're going through so many different landlords. So I'm up all night long. All night long trying to find somewhere to stay.
Williams got on the program in 2010, 2 years after being hit by a pickup truck on the side of a Dallas highway.
I broke the first vertebrae in my neck. I broke my right shoulder. My hips were completely crushed, like literally in pieces. My pelvic was broken in three places.
So that led to disability.
Disability.
Lifelong?
Lifelong. There's a lot of cracks and stuff in the ceiling.
Williams considered herself lucky when she first found this house in Mesquite with her voucher.
I've been here 7 years. Love my landlord, love my house. But what has happened? My house has started to fall apart, piece by piece. Literally every time it rains, the whole thing.
And does it flood your kitchen?
Yes, every single time.
Now she's back to square one, competing against other renters for a limited supply of houses in Dallas's more desirable suburban neighborhoods. Along the way, she says she's faced bias from landlords.
They automatically assume that you're going to, because you're on Section 8, that you're dirty or that you're almost not worthy of having a nice house because you need the help.
Moving is stressful for all of us. Moving with a Section 8 voucher is overwhelming.
Hello, this is Ann Lott.
Ann Lott runs the Inclusive Communities Project, a Texas nonprofit that helps people on housing choice vouchers. She hears stories like Cassie Lee Williams often.
As a matter of fact, in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, 93% of the landlords will not take a housing choice voucher.
A big reason for that, Lott says, is that in Texas, landlords can legally discriminate against prospective tenants who use voucher income for a portion of their rent.
From what I understand, Black families are disproportionately affected.
Approximately 85% of the families that we serve that have on the voucher program are African American. But unfortunately, what we found is that even with the voucher, the only areas that would accept Section 8 would be those high minority, high poverty areas.
You're speaking in past tense. Isn't that the case now?
That is still the case.
Thank you very much.
When President Nixon created the Section 8 program as an alternative to government-funded public housing developments, it allowed low-income Americans to take their rental assistance with them, giving them the opportunity to live outside of segregated neighborhoods.
So the idea that families wouldn't be tied to these units and could go, you know, purchase housing elsewhere, I think was an exciting prospect.
But 50 years later, the program hasn't lived up to its full promise, says Stephanie DeLuca, director of the Poverty and Inequality Research Lab at Johns Hopkins University.
Most voucher holders in the U.S. live in moderate to high poverty neighborhoods. And frankly, we've privatized public housing in the U.S., and that means that landlords are our housing providers. And the program rests on our ability to not only get their participation, but meet their needs as well.
Across the country, the number of vouchers is determined by annual funding from Congress. But studies have found that funding hasn't kept up with rental prices. Another problem is housing supply, says Kevin Corinth with the Conservative American Enterprise Institute.
If we can only build, 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 and build some more, that's the only way we have a potential chance of getting families access to these high opportunity areas that have been demonstrated to have major successful outcomes for themselves and for their kids.
A lack of affordable housing has led to a surge in homelessness in cities like San Francisco, Los Angeles, and New York. But here in Seattle, one of the nation's least affordable cities, there's a renewed focus on housing vouchers and how to make the system work better for applicants and landlords.
This is one of our studio apartments. Mm-hmm. It's about 250 square feet.
Ben Moritz is a landlord who owns about 900 affordable apartment units in the city.
We've built a lot of housing, especially the kind of basic low frills housing like what you're seeing here, that is a very good fit for the voucher program.
Unlike in Dallas, landlords here cannot deny applicants on the basis of their income source. And Moritz says the Seattle Housing Authority makes it easy to rent to tenants with vouchers.
The downside and the risks aren't that much. And frankly, our business does better when we have those kinds of stable rent payments that come from a voucher resident. They're very easy to work with, they pay on time, they pay electronically, and they have a pretty good case management and dispute resolution system.
Tysonia McLean with the Seattle Housing Authority says the city tries to address landlords' concerns.
If a tenant falls behind on rent, they can submit a referral and get assistance with that rent amount. If the tenant decides to move out and leaves a high utility bill, they can get assistance with that. If something were to happen and the unit was left damaged, they can receive funds up to $5,000 to repair those damages.
There's a total of three people in the household, correct?
Yes.
They also lend a hand to prospective tenants. McLean leads a team of housing counselors who help connect individuals with potential resources, like help with paying for moving costs, security deposits, and application fees.
Of course, the main way you can always, apply is through our online applications process.
Since January, the Housing Authority has been holding public information sessions for people hoping to get on the waiting list for a housing choice voucher. It's been 7 years since Seattle opened that list to applicants.
We get calls every day through our referral line about housing. I'm sleeping in my car, I'm sleeping in Tent City, I'm sleeping on someone's couch.
Seattle is hoping to distribute 800 housing choice vouchers by the end of the year, but already 14,000 people have applied. Whether an individual or family gets one is based largely on luck, says Kevin Corinth, who believes the program should be redesigned.
It's essentially a lottery. Those who are very lucky will get assistance, everyone else gets nothing. Another problem is that it discourages families from earning more. Basically, your rent effectively goes up if you earn more money, which can discourage upward mobility.
So what are you going to get?
A maple bar.
But for those who receive one, like 42-year-old Sarah Richardson, a housing choice voucher can be life-changing.
I don't know where we would be today without the voucher.
She got one from the Seattle Housing Authority in 2017. Growing up, Richardson says she battled homelessness and later drug addiction and incarceration. Having a permanent home helped her turn her life around.
So when I got the news that my number came up on the wait list, I cried. I screamed. I was so excited because I knew that finally I was going to feel stable.
Stability and also opportunities for her 11-year-old daughter, Jabria, that she didn't have. Their voucher afforded them a house in one of Seattle's better neighborhoods. Her 21-year-old goddaughter, Aaliyah, also lives in the home. Seattle's commitment to making the process easier was crucial.
What's next? What are your greatest hopes for the future?
Getting my daughter through middle school and high school, and that's like what my goal is to push and help and be the best mom that I can be.
Hey, girl!
Back in Texas, Cassalee Williams has the same simple dream. But when we left them, they were still sending out applications to landlords.
How optimistic are you feeling about this?
Honestly, I'm trying to be as positive as I possibly can, even though it's terrifying. It's terrifying because you just don't know.
Last week, after 2.5 months of searching, the Williams family finally found a rental and a landlord who will accept their voucher. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
As a New York City high school English teacher, Adrian Onteo has embraced technology to support his students. While some express concern about the influence of AI on education, Onteo has worked with educators, coders, and designers to develop an AI tool that helps students with their writing revisions. He shares his brief but spectacular take on harnessing AI in schools.
Here it is, the argument essay. It's a yes-no question that needs an answer in the intro.
Because I've taught for close to 20 years, I've taught almost every English class the school has offered.
Why did the author want to write these four paragraphs?
I've wanted to be a teacher since I was 10 years old. Initially, I thought it was a job that would garner you respect as an adult. As I got older, I fell in love with literature and have lucked into a dream job. OpenAI dropped ChatGPT on all of us last November. My initial reaction was terror. The summer began with me sitting in on conversations about how to adapt AI for the classroom. And by July, we began a partnership with a company called PlayLab that provided an open platform for teachers to create their own AI bot. I'm going on to Project Tony. It's an AI chatbot that can be a teaching assistant for teachers and a writing tutor for students. So I'm going to put in the assignment. It is designed to read articles that students are also reading so they can engage in the conversation to begin the revision process. Tony will provide strengths and areas for improvement for each paragraph. The problem that I had in mind was largely the jealousy I felt toward math teachers and science teachers who can give instant feedback to students during tutoring. If I assign a 5-page essay, that's a 500-page novel that I would have to get through. Before Tony existed, the feedback cycle largely mimicked the letter writing that you would see in Jane Austen movies, roughly 2 to 3 weeks, and this shrinks that feedback cycle to 24 to 72 hours.
Remember what I told you on Tuesday.
Introducing Project Tony into the classroom has been fascinating. What I'm discovering is that I'm needing to teach them how to use it well. Just press 1, and Tony will give paragraph by paragraph suggestions. It's not Alexa or Google. You don't just give it simple commands. You have to engage with it. Specifically, could you elaborate on why this was a poor example? And it will give you 2 to 3 sentences of explanation. And you can convince Tony that it was incorrect. But what that takes is for you to make a stand for your own writing, which is such a huge move in a writer's psychology to have the confidence in your own sentences, where often students are coming from a space of doubt and fear. You're entering in a partnership the way a professional writer and a professional editor enters into a conversation, and they're both engaged in trying to make the writing better.
The P is the purpose.
One of the goals of being a good teacher is to give them academic attention and show them how intelligent they are. What I enjoy most about teaching writing is seeing growth in one of my students. It fills me up the way a great sentence in a novel fills me up. It's a really fulfilling experience. My name is Adrian Onteo, and this is my brief but spectacular take on harnessing AI in schools.
Tonight's Brief But Spectacular is part of a 6-part collection on the future of education.
And you can watch the entire series on our website. That's pbs.org/newshour.
And join us again here tomorrow night when we report on the warnings of imminent famine in Gaza and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's fight to keep his grip on power. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Amna Nawaz.
And I'm Jeff Bennett. Thanks for joining us, and have a good evening.